This is a podcast from 720 to go.
We're
WGN Radio.
The voices in your head.
You know what they say, when it's time to feed your head, Milt Rosenberg's got the biggest ladle.
Welcome to another edition of the Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg podcast. This week we're featuring a segment dating back to July 30th, 1986. Milt welcomes that famous debunker of the mystical, James Randi. In this interview, Randi sheds light on phonies, including those who claim to bend spoons with the power of their thoughts. Thanks again for downloading the Extension 720 podcast, and enjoy the show.
Here you are. Last night you were on the Johnny Carson show, and we don't have any fellow with a 10-foot-long mustache to precede you on this program. But since it's radio, it wouldn't really help if we did, would it?
I got to tell you, when the man walked out with the, what is it, 5-foot, 10-inch mustache or
no,
whatever?
No, it was a 10 feet.
The record is 7.
Each side, I think.
Almost. Who cares? Yeah. It's a big, big mustache. And when he walked out on the set, Carson had not yet seen him.
I know. I saw him break out.
The reaction that Carson had, Fred DeCordova, the producer, was saying backstage, he says, he is going to go out of his mind when he sees this. He won't believe it. And it does look like a fake. And the laughter that Carson came out with, I mean, tears coming down the face and everything. Mm-hmm. I saw the guy myself. Listen, I went into my dressing room in the Carson show, Milt, and there's a sliding door at one side. I said, this must be the cupboard. I opened it up, and this guy's sitting there with the mustache that you can't get through a barn door with, you know?
Could it have been a hoax, a psychic fraud of some kind?
It could have been, in which case I would have set fire to him immediately.
Of course, the basic question there is it a real mustache or a fake mustache? How could you have determined that apart from pulling at it?
I think pulling at it is the best way.
I've always wanted
to do that, yes.
You've been pulling at a lot of other people, not because they have false mustaches, and this fellow had a true rather than a false mustache, but you've been pulling at a lot of people who make very false claims about their powers. You've been doing this for years, and you are, in essence, the greatest investigator of psychic and paranormal or parapsychological fraud in the Western world. I hope there's an equivalent in the Eastern world. I don't know whether they pursue such fraud in the Soviet Union. They've got some people who claim great powers there.
Oh, they got fooled. They got fooled many, many times. I'm happy to see that the Soviets have put just as much money into investigation of this sort of thing through the government, and that they've got just as many frauds over there. There's a thing called the Psi Gap that the Pentagon is worried about. You see all kinds of gaps.
Like a missile gap.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And this is PSI, Psi, the Greek letter Psi, standing for all things that go bump in the night. And the parapsychologists love that letter, and they call everything a psi phenomenon, you see. Well, I can assure you, there is no psi gap between the Soviets and the United States, because what we're doing, spending millions of dollars on it, they're spending millions of rubles. There may be other kinds of gaps, but there's no psi gap, and there is no dunderhead gap, because just as many people there are working on it.
I thought Ingo Swann was here once many years ago. He's one of the guys that our government invested in. What does he do? Distant, what do you call that?
Well, he's fundamentally an artist.
But he claims to do distant viewing,
yes,
or whatever they call it.
He claims to do remote viewing and traveling through space and various other things.
So that, among other things, he could look at secret Soviet military installations through the mind's eye, as it were,
right,
and tell us what's
right
there, though our diplomats can't get there with their little cameras. It occurred to me at the time that he was here that he may have been put up to all of this by the CIA as a way of faking the commies into spending a lot of money trying to duplicate these unduplicatable feats.
Unduplicatable. I wish that were so. That has been suspected as well, and I sort of wish it were so.
You don't think they're that smart?
No, I don't think the government is that smart to put them up to a thing like that.
And they were taken in also.
They really believed them, yeah.
Well, that, of course, is the great and fascinating thing, and that is the dilemma, the paradox, and the troubling thing about modern mentality that bothers you and your many colleagues in the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, acronym PSYCOP. That there is a great degree of culpability out there, even among the supposedly sophisticated, the supposedly educated.
Yeah, and people who have PhDs after their names, they often say, gee, I'm intelligent, I'm well-educated, and I'm a good observer, therefore if I see something I don't understand, it's supernatural, which is not necessarily the conclusion you come to, because magicians, like myself, pull rabbits out of hats. And you say to some scientist someplace who's a great observer and so intelligent and whatnot, you say, how does the magician pull the rabbit out of the hat? Well, I don't know that, is the answer. You say, well, then why would you know that a spoon being bent before your very eyes, as they say in the trade, that that's done by psychic means? Well, because that's not a trick. If it's not listed in a magic catalog someplace, they consider it to be something that's not a magic trick.
An excellent case in point are the few physicists around the world, one down in Texas, one or two over in London, and yet elsewhere, who've had people with paranormal psychic powers into their laboratories and have confirmed through scientific testing that Uri Geller or Ingo Swann or whoever is capable of these magical paranormal feats. Mm-hmm. Who's that particular fellow in London who had the spoon-bending children that he was quite convinced were authentic until you began to make
trouble for him?
Yeah, there
are two of them. One was John Taylor. I think that's the one you're talking mm-hmm. about. He's professor of mathematics at King's College. And I must say, in John's defense, that he had the intestinal fortitude, not often found among academics, to actually say in a roundabout way, I was wrong.
But there's that other one. There's that other one who's a physicist.
Oh, Hasted.
Hasted.
Yeah, John Hasted. Well, John Hasted will never say he's wrong because those words don't form in his mouth. It sticks behind his lip, and he just can't say, I was wrong. And I don't think he thinks he was wrong. He still thinks that he was right and that the spoon-bending children of England could not possibly have deceived him.
Whereas you were able to establish that the spoon-bending children were bending their spoons how?
By simply taking them between your hands and bending them when no one was looking. And they established that rather firmly at the University of Bath. We'd say Bath, they say Bath. And they did it sort of by accident. You see, the idea was, Milt, that if you observe these things carefully, they don't like to happen. That was called the shyness effect. That was mm-hmm. invented by John Taylor, who recanted, as we said, later on. And they went along with the shyness effect, and they decided they would do this experiment with a group, I think there were 8 children involved, who had a reputation for being able to bend cutlery psychically by just concentrating on it, although stroking it with their little fingers.
Were these the illegitimate children of Uri Geller, or what?
Who knows? I've always suspected that, but I have no proof whatsoever of their lineage, and I don't think we should get into that for fear of litigation. Lineage litigation, or whatever. However, these 8 children were sitting in a row, and they had a big mirror in front of them, one of these one-way mirrors, psychological laboratory, and behind it they had video cameras covering the children at all times and never being turned off, and the 2 scientists in the white coats who were working with the kids would give them spoons and make them promise not to bend them actually by bending them between your hands, but only by stroking them and concentrating. And the kids all said, sure. One of them was as young as 5 years of age. And they're all sitting in the chairs, and the mothers are sitting outside watching them. And the video cameras, unknown to the kids, are watching them through the one-way mirror. Mm-hmm. And then, because of the shyness effect, now this is naivete of a very high order. The fellow named Collins, the psychologist there, had heard that if you actually view it with your own eyes, that means there's a human consciousness viewing it, and therefore you mustn't watch the monitors or look through the camera, and you mustn't look through the glass. So at a prearranged signal, the scientists in the white coats turned away from the children, and the video operators of the cameras were to turn away from the monitors and cover their eyes, so only the Vidicon, the little tube inside the TV camera, would be watching the kids. And lo and behold, when they turned back, 7 of the 8 kids had bent spoons. And they said, hey, the experiment worked, because only the kids were watching the spoons. But then they played back the videotape. And all 8 kids either placed the spoons underneath their feet when the scientists turned away.
That's one way to bend a spoon.
Or helped one another to try to bend the spoons. But the only one who didn't was the 5-year-old kid, who put it under his foot and strained mightily and was unable to do it and burst out into tears. He couldn't bend the spoon.
And this is the sort of performance which, done earlier just with Hasted looking on, persuaded Hasted that spoon bending through mental power is a reality.
Absolutely. In fact, we did Julie Knowles, who was a young lady there that Hasted highly recommended. Her mother brought her in to try to collect my $10,000 prize for any paranormal event under proper observing conditions. And Julie Knowles sat in a chair and started to stroke on the spoon, but she wasn't very successful. We spent several hours of her stroking her finger off, and we had blackened the underside of the bowl of the spoon with candle black, so that...
As reported in your great book, Flim Flam, which I trust is still in print.
Oh, indeed. It's in its 4th softcover printing right now.
Published these days by Prometheus Books.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we sold 7,000 copies in 48 hours when Carson flashed the book, by the way, Milt. I trust we sold at least another 4 copies now. I would trust that. Now, if not...
Because
I
said
it tonight,
every time I say Flim Flam, that sells at least 50 copies.
There you go. Okay, I'll consult with my publisher.
So we've already sold 100 because I said it twice.
There you go. Flim Flam, Flim Flam, Flim Flam. Anyway, in the book, we do have a diagram of Julian Knowles sitting in front of the camera. And poor Hasted, I say poor Hasted because the man is deluding himself, sat across on the other side of the laboratory saying, oh, sorry, Julie, I see it bending. Oh, shit, it's bending all right. Hey, there she goes. Whoa, I can see it from where I am. That spoon didn't go 1 millimeter.
What else has engaged your interest. One thing, so much has, one thing that I remember you were much interested in, and was in the news again just yesterday, is dowsing. The desperate farmers of the Southeast, suffering from that drought, are now hiring dowsers who are running all over Georgia and Alabama, bending their twigs or their metal rods to uncover new sources of water.
And to no avail whatsoever. Those dowsers aren't going to find anything more than dust.
You did some very systematic studies on that,
I
remember.
Yeah, in Australia and in Venezuela, all over the world, as a matter of fact. In Italy, some of the tests are outlined in the book.
Which book?
Flim Flam.
Oh, Flim Flam, yes. Right.
In the book Flim Flam, we do have, I think, the last chapter is pretty well full of the rather extensive tests done in Italy. But we learned a lot since then. We learned how to cut down on the time and increase the efficiency of the tests. And in Australia, a year after the book came out, I went over there at the behest of a millionaire gentleman who has been very friendly to that local group over here. And I want to mention the local group over here as well, who are practically seated at our elbows as we speak here.
These are friends from the newly formed Midwest Committee for Rational Inquiry, which is the name they've given themselves. They are an affiliate of a local affiliate of SciComm.
Indeed, and very valuable to us, I can assure everyone. These local groups, one of them was started in Australia some years ago, as I say, were not only useful to us, but they instigated things. They actually started them and followed them through, and followed them long after I had to leave the country. But I did go over there. I did some very extensive tests lasting over a couple of weeks of a group of dowsers. We started out with about 30 dowsers. The prize was $120,000, not 10. And $120,000 American dollars or Australian dollars will buy an awful lot of dowsing sticks, I can assure you. And these people were very enthusiastic. In fact, it was really sort of sad. They dropped down to 11 eventually when they found out that the terms of the test were going to be very rigid, though quite fair. And they agreed that the test was just. But they were already out shopping for the new home and for the video machines and all that sort of thing, videotape machines. And it was sort of sad to have to announce them at the end that in all of those days of testing and many hundreds of individual tests, that they had achieved 11%, where expected success would be 10%, and they expected their success to be anywhere from 80 to 100%.
What were they dowsing for? It wasn't just water.
No, several different things. Some of them could douse for gold. One poor chap showed up.
You let them douse for whatever they claimed
they could do. They have to do things according to their own claim. And we had water running in pipes, and they said they could do it in pipes, and they illustrated that when they knew in which one of 10 pipes it was flowing, their dowsing stick would always descend invariably on that pipe. But then when they were suddenly cut off and it was chosen by a random means, and that was done by a randomizer, that they didn't have any more than chance than 1 in 10, approximately, of finding in which one it was. But the gold dowser was a really sad fellow. He showed up in one of these big Aussie hats, and he was a charmer. But he was in rags, and we sort of wondered because he said that he practically made a living doing gold dowsing, and he said he could find the gold in your teeth. I said, well, that's wonderful. The more gold, the better. And he said, oh, yes, if you have a lot of gold, he said, it's all that more powerful. So we went off to the bank, and we got a $21,000 ingot of gold. Now, that's about the size of a small pack of cards. And believe me, it feels good, Mel. Have you ever felt an ingot of gold like that?
I've not even been in the same room with one.
You should get a hold of one just for the thrill. I mean, it's nice and heavy, and you can rub it all over your body, you know, and it feels great, and you want to run away with it. In fact, the bank sent along two rather heavy-set gentlemen with big black automatics who glowered at me all the time during the experiment after I did a few sleight-of-hand tricks with the piece of gold to show that it could be done, sort of demonstrate.
You made the gold disappear.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say it, because it always came back instantly when they reached for the guns. You'd be surprised. Anyway, we took that ingot of gold and we placed it in one of 10 boxes chosen by a random means. And this gentleman was supposed to do 10 attempts to find it. We said in advance, how many times do you think you'll find it? He said, oh, 10 times out of 10. I never fail. I said, oh, well, then we're all set. And I've lost my $10,000, and the other gentleman has lost his $10,000, and Dick Smith, the millionaire, has lost $100,000. And he grinned at us. He said, you betcha. So we did 5 of the tests, and he said, well, I want to stop now. And I said, oh, no, you got to do the other 5. Now, at that point, Mel, I must add this, it was a double-blind test. At that point, I didn't know whether he had been successful in even one of them. Or all 5. I had
somebody
no
else
idea.
Was moving the ingot.
That's
around.
Right. Someone else was moving it, and someone else was doing the determining of which box it was in.
Right.
There were several teams, you see. None of us knew until we got our results together at the end.
Proper design.
That's right.
A proper experimental design.
Exactly. So he wanted to stop after 5, and I said, why? He said, I'll take half the money. And I said, no, 10 tests is 10 tests. You got to do the whole thing. That's what we decided, and that's how we do a scientific test. And he said, oh, all right, but I don't think you'll give me the money. And I said, listen, it's already here in the form of checks. It's been given to Reverend whoever he was over there, so we know that it's in safe hands.
All right, now the payoff question. Out of the 10, how many correct passes, if any?
Zero.
Zero, of course.
And then you know what he said? They said, well, how do you explain that? And he said, well, I can't explain it. I said, wait a minute. I took the gold and I put it in one of the boxes. I said, show us how it works. And he walked over to it, and of course the stick, boom, jumped down at the box. Mm-hmm. Walked over here, boom, down to the box again in three different locations. Then I said, okay, now you move the box. And he picked it up and he practically went over his head because I'd palmed the gold out, much to the dismay of the two heavyset gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't in the box when he was trying the experiment, and yet when he thought it was there, the dowsing stick went down.
Oh, you devil.
Yes, and he said to us afterwards, about 2 hours afterwards, he came to us and said, I know why it didn't work. You were using walkie-talkies. Now, if you can figure that out, I've got some swampland in Florida that I will award you.
The preceding was a production of 720 to Go.
For over three decades, Milt Rosenberg has been feeding your head. Get a mindful on Extension 720, weeknights at 9 on 720 WGN.